The People's History of Kansas City podcast is supported by the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art, celebrating 30 years at the Block Party on Saturday, May 4th. Visitors can enjoy music, food trucks, exhibitions, and artist-led activities. Learn more at kemperart.org.
You listen to A People's History of Kansas City for a fresh take on local history. We want to honor these stories, and we take the reporting very seriously. And sometimes we just need to chill. Wanna hang? Let's party! Join us at our annual benefit, Radioactive, on June 14th. NPR's All Things Considered host Ari Shapiro will make a special appearance, and boy, it's gonna be bumping. You gotta be there. Please come support our work. Ticket information is available at kcur.org/radioactive.
A cookie was born 112 years ago today that would become the best-selling cookie in the world.
Oreo cream sandwich,
Nabisco. Oreo's contributions to the world are huge. They're now sold in more than 100 countries. Of course, you've got, you know, the classic, and then there's double stuffed versions. But then there's also these kind of wild styles like wasabi flavored or peanut butter and jelly, Swedish fish, green tea. But what a lot of people might not know is that 4 years before Oreos came on the scene, it was actually a Kansas City company that first thought to pair two chocolate wafers with vanilla cream.
Yeah, did you know that Hydrox is the original cream-filled chocolate cookie?
Hydrox cookies, a creation of prolific Kansas City philanthropist Jacob Luce, were incredibly popular in the early 1900s. So why is it that more than a century later, one cookie is America's favorite, while the other is mostly pulled out as a clue for crosswords and trivia contests, but otherwise unknown?
Not only was Oreo this copycat of Hydrox, it was also built on the back of the company that Jacob had founded himself.
I'm Suzanne Hogan. This is A People's History of Kansas City. And on this episode, the Sandwich Cookie Wars. So I've eaten a lot of cookies in my day, but I had never heard of Hydrox until producer Mackenzie Martin was like, you need to know about this. So Mackenzie, how did you learn about Hydrox cookies?
Well, I feel like I've always been aware of Hydrox because it's this famous David and Goliath story. But I only learned that they were from Kansas City last year when I just randomly Googled it. And it blew my mind because I've never seen this advertised anywhere.
Okay, well, hold up. You knew about Hydrox before? Like, you had heard what you,
oh,
like...
Oh, yeah. Like, Hydrox is a big-time national running joke for being second best. People are always making fun of Hydrox for not being as good as Oreos or as popular as Oreos.
Enjoy your Hydrox cookies and your silver medal, Mr. Vice President.
Would you like another Hydrox?
No, thank you. I'm all Hydroxed out.
They also really cheap out on the snacks. Hydrox cookies.
So what does that say about me that I don't know anything about this?
I think you've missed a lot of pop culture references because you don't know about Hydrox.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to be enlightened.
Okay, so one of the first people I talked to about Hydrox cookies was Andrea Broomfield, who has written several books about Kansas City's food history. We've had her on the show before.
Yes, I know Andrea. She's great.
And would you agree she's like the Kansas City food historian?
Absolutely. Yeah, when in doubt, if I have a question about anything related to Kansas City food or restaurant history, it's like you call Andrea.
Exactly. So I figured maybe the general public in Kansas City, not familiar with these cookies, but surely Andrea Broomfield cares and is passionate about these cookies. But I was wrong.
Until you got a hold of me, Hydrox was not in any part of my mind at all. But the minute you said it, I had a negative remembrance of those cookies.
A negative remembrance.
Yes. Andrea hated Hydrox.
I was born in 1965. And like most kids growing up in suburbia Kansas City, we loved Oreos more than Hydrox because Hydrox cookies seemed like they were boring, like the flavor was boring. Hydrox looked like something that my grandmother would eat.
Growing up, Andrea had no idea they were even from here.
You know, there's always this story that the Hydrox was the knockoff, and we've believed that.
Okay, so I know what an Oreo is. I like Oreos. I've never had a Hydrox cookie that I know of. Like, I can't, like, picture it. And so I'm kind of wondering, it's like, so, like, are they any good? I mean, sometimes there's a reason why you don't know about something.
So this was my question, too, which is why I have spent the last couple weeks kind of looking into this. I've been reaching out to people on Kansas City history groups and asking around, does anyone remember Hydrox and does anyone care about them? And Suzanne, I was shocked at how many people, including a number of our KCUR colleagues, just immediately had these vivid flashbacks of eating Hydrox cookies.
One day we were having dinner, and for dessert, Meemaw brought out Hydrox cookies. I had never had sandwich cookies like this before. I'd never seen anything like this before. I fell in love.
I remember getting them out, getting the milk out, because you couldn't have a sandwich cookie without milk.
I was the kind that liked to open them up, slowly tasting all of that sugar. I was, you know, we were sugar freaks.
When I was a little kid, I preferred Oreos, but my sister pointed something out. A Hydrox cookie tastes sharper. It's got a much more sophisticated taste than an Oreo.
I remember going to a friend's house and they had Oreos. And because of the branding, I thought, well, these are probably better or whatever, but they weren't. I preferred Hydrox.
It's cool to hear people have such vivid memories about them specifically. Because it's like, I think part of my thing is when you say the word Hydrox, I don't have an immediate memory related to that brand. But when you say Oreo, I do.
I think whichever one you ate growing up, it's kind of a similar thing in that these memories are a really powerful thing. And this is something I talked about with Stella Parks, who is a food writer and nationally known pastry chef. Obviously, pastry chefs, you wouldn't think they would be into Oreos. And when Stella was just starting her career, she wasn't.
You come out of culinary school with your nose in the air a little bit. And you're like, oh, I only make things from scratch. And oh, you know, I only eat cream puffs.
But then one day, her whole mindset shifted. At the time, she was far away from home, living in Japan.
I'd been doing pretty well. And then one day I was at this little, like, tiny supermarket corner store. And as I was, like, walking down the aisle, I just saw this, like, kind of flash of blue in the corner of my eye. And I glanced over, and it was a package of Oreos. And suddenly, it was just, like, this wave of nostalgia hit me. And I felt so homesick in a way that I had not felt maybe ever. I guess it was like my Proust moment where I realized like what a strong connection these foods have and that my childhood was not any less rich because it was built on these kind of packaged food-based memories.
And this tiny package of Oreos changed the course of Stella Park's career. The first big food story she ever wrote was about the history of the Oreo, a story that went on to be included in her James Beard award-winning cookbook, Brave Tart, which also features recipes for iconic American desserts like Twinkies, Snickers, Thin Mints, Wonder Bread.
You know, I guess from there, like, the Oreo became even more important to me in my own mythology. But of course, the most important thing in the Oreo mythology is, in fact, the Hydrox. And that just brings it back to the beginning.
Okay, so Suzanne, we cannot talk about Hydrox cookies without talking about Jacob Luce. Are you familiar with him?
Yes, and I'm surprised to hear that.
What do you know about him?
Oh, shit. What do I know about him? I know that there is a giant park.
Yes.
In the Brookside area that is thanks to him and his legacy. I cannot remember how he made his wealth.
So Luce Park was donated to the city in his honor after he died, among other things, because Luce was a very important Kansas City philanthropist. But our story starts in 1870. Jacob Luce is 20 years old. Born in Greencastle, Pennsylvania, he moves to southeastern Kansas to get into the dry goods business. Then, in his 30s, he makes likely the smartest decision of his young life. He and his brother, Joseph Luce, take over the Coral Cracker and Confectionery Company in Kansas City, Missouri.
He seemed to be very interested in not making a name for himself, per se, but, like, achieving something.
Stella Parks says the mid to late 1800s is when manufactured crackers and cookies were just starting to pop up in America. Sugar wafers, Fig Newtons,
packaged little biscuits, tea cookies.
And it dawns on Jacob that they would make a lot more money if they had less competition with other Midwest bakeries. So in 1890, Jacob hires this big shot lawyer in Chicago, Adolphus Green, to get everyone together. And cooperatively, they form the American Biscuit and Manufacturing Company. Jacob becomes president, Joseph is appointed to the board of directors, and Adolphus becomes their general counsel. One of the 40 or so bakeries that joins is Frank L. Summer and Company, based in St. Joseph, and they are often credited with inventing saltine crackers.
No shit.
pretty fun fact. But American Biscuit does not have a monopoly because there are two other very similar big bakery corporations. There's the United States Baking Company and the New York Biscuit Company.
Is this like pre-Nabisco type stuff?
Yes. And this intense competition becomes a full-on biscuit war, with these companies constantly trying to outdo each other.
And so you started seeing, like, animal crackers and vanilla wafers and graham crackers.
But by 1897, the heads of the three companies are understandably sick of competing. Jacob Luce is in pretty poor health, so he steps back from the company, which leaves Adolphus Green and Jacob's brother Joseph in charge.
Joseph was the one who was really interested in the notion of creating a bigger trust.
This is Andrea Broomfield again.
Whereas Jacob was not. And since he was sick and convalescing in Europe, he couldn't really do much about what Joseph was doing.
Against Jacob's wishes, the American Biscuit Company merges with the other two big biscuit empires in 1899. And they form a powerhouse called the National Biscuit Company. Suzanne, does that bring anything to mind for you? The National Biscuit Company?
The Nabisco. Oh, so I was right to say Nabisco earlier.
Yeah, I'm really impressed you got that right away. So, yeah.
I eat a lot of saltines.
National Biscuit Company didn't officially change its name until much later, but we will just call it Nabisco. But anyway, Jacob Luce is now rich after this merger. His health is better. He comes home from Europe to a completely new cookie landscape.
He could have retired after the merger. Certainly he had stakes in the company that he would have profited from it.
But Jacob Luce doesn't retire because he's bitter about the merger slash power grab. So in 1902, Jacob announces that he is going after Nabisco. He forms a new business, the Luce Wiles Biscuit Company, with his brother Joseph and their friend John Wiles. At the time, the Wall Street Journal calls Jacob the, quote, best known bakery magnate in the country. And is basically like, Nabisco should be worried. And they were right, because over the next 6 months, 40 or so employees quit Nabisco to go work for Luce Wiles, which obviously pisses off Nabisco.
The two companies were constantly trying to compete by offering very similar types of cookies or biscuits. The famous Nabisco biscuit was called Unita, and Luce Wiles responded with Tacoma. So, you know, you need a biscuit or take home a biscuit.
Nabisco's Unita biscuit was super popular because it was the first cracker that stayed really fresh. Like, it used to be that crackers were sold in barrels, which got disgusting towards the bottom, you know, the bottom of the barrel. But Nabisco perfected this technology they called the inner seal, which was this ingenious system of inner folded layers of wax paper and cardboard that kept things super fresh. In order to compete, the Luce brothers needed something special and innovative. Something like chocolate. Native to Central and South America, for centuries, chocolate was imported, making it a delicacy. It wasn't until the mid to late 1800s that we got innovations like cocoa powder and milk chocolate. So the Luce brothers see this trend, and in 1908, they do something no one has done before. They put two crisp, bitter dark chocolate wafers around a layer of sweet vanilla cream, and they call it Hydrox. It was America's first chocolate sandwich cookie, and it had this really ornate pattern.
When it hits your tongue, like, you can feel that embossed design on it. Like, that's a completely different, like, experience.
Stella Parks says this design put other cookies, which were merely molded in the shape of an animal or stamped with a name, completely to shame.
The Hydrox had this, like, really elaborate laurel wreath and this really elaborate font. It was like a very Baroque sort of cookie.
I'm curious why the name Hydrox.
I love that I knew you were going to ask that. So the name obviously stands out compared to other cookies. It sounds a bit chemically. But back then, Hydrox fit into this American obsession with food sanitation.
It's supposed to be like hydrogen and oxygen are these pure, clean elements. There's nothing cleaner. There's nothing finer.
Hydrox wasn't intended to be an everyday cookie. It was a special event, billed as the aristocrat of cookies, a dessert completely by itself. And it especially took off at soda shops and pharmacies. Fast forward to 1912, 4 years after Hydrox's debut, and Luce Wiles has beautiful sunlit factories in Kansas City, Minneapolis, Dallas, St. Louis, Chicago, and Boston. At a time when most Americans think of factories as dirty and unsafe places to work, Luce Wiles is trying to be a clear outlier.
I really have a lot of admiration for Jacob Luce, that he wanted to bring all this light into the work floor, both for promoting sanitation and health, but also for the well-being of his employees.
1912 is also the year Luce Wiles debuts its brand new Thousand Window Bakery in Long Island, New York, which takes the title of the world's largest bakery, a distinction it holds for more than 40 years. Nabisco responds to this by building its own enormous bakery on 11th Avenue in Manhattan. Meanwhile, the hype around Luce Wiles gets a New York Globe journalist suspicious, so he makes a surprise visit to the factory, and he finds that not only is Luce Wiles using more premium butter and making their own vanilla, but they have women's restrooms furnished with beautiful rugs and lounge chairs, a laundry room, and trained nurses on site.
Delightful.
So the journalist comes to the conclusion, and I'm just going to quote here, that it is impossible to go through that wonderfully tiled, perfectly ventilated, sunlit institution with every modern sanitary device installed without paying tribute to the genius which has devised it. So once again, Jacob Luce is the owner of one of America's largest corporate bakeries, second only to his ultimate rival, Nabisco.
Who owns Nabisco? Who's like the guy, who's the Luce of Nabisco?
Well, it's funny you should ask because do you remember the lawyer that helped him? Adolphus Green eventually becomes the head of Nabisco.
Okay. I kind of had a feeling something like that was in the works.
So that year, Luce Wiles made a mere $12 million in sales compared to Nabisco's $45 million. But they were still seen as a real competitor.
There's a publication called the United States Investor, and they had this one article. The headline was "Exchange National for Luce Wiles." So they're literally saying, like, abandon your stocks at Nabisco. Luce Wiles is really pulling ahead here.
Then, on the 10th anniversary of the Luce Wiles Biscuit Company, Adolphus Green and Nabisco unveiled their own sandwich cookie, the Oreo Biscuit.
It has a very similar ornate design and a chocolate cracker with vanilla.
You are correct. It was advertised as two beautifully embossed chocolate-flavored wafers with a rich cream filling.
Not only was Oreo this copycat of Hydrox, it was also built on the back of the company that Jacob had founded himself.
And it is worth noting that Hydrox and Oreo were just one of the categories these two biscuit companies were competing in. Luce Wiles starts to brand itself as Sunshine Biscuits. Have you ever heard of that?
Yes, yes, yes.
And they also made Lemon Coolers, which were these citrusy powdered sugar cookies.
Yes, I love Lemon Coolers.
Wait, you've heard of them?
Yes.
Who can make the sunshine in the middle of the night? bake cheese it high ho to make the party right. The Baker Man can. The Sunshine Baker Man can.
American the Baker Man can. Baked in. That's from Willy Wonka.
Yeah, it does kind of feel Willy Wonka-esque at times, though, because they also produce candy. So they're making, like, cinnamon drops and licorice lozenges. Mm. And at one point, Loose Wiles had the largest single candy factory in the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah. Reporters attributed the success of Sunshine Biscuits to Jacob Loose and the way he encouraged and inspired his workers. Like, he was always seeking advice from younger employees. But in 1923, Jacob dies, a year after his brother Joseph, and leadership of the company is taken over by other employees, like his co-founder, John Wiles. Both men, exceptionally driven in the business world, but they approach things a bit differently.
My great-grandfather, John H. Wiles, wasn't good with the employees. He was mean.
So that's Wendy Case, who says she's John Wiles' great-granddaughter. And according to her, he was incredibly anti-union, which is relevant.
I was going to, okay.
Yeah.
I was going to ask this because when you were painting the picture of Loose and da-da-da, I was like, all right, but how is he with unions?
So I read a lot of old newspaper articles about Loose Wiles, and I found some union activity around 1917, but it didn't really take off until after Jacob Loose's death. So he dies in 1923, and then from the 1920s through the 40s, are several high-profile labor strikes. And this, among other things, contributes to less company revenue. So you can probably tell this is kind of how the company is slowing down. And then the next thing that happens is in the mid-50s, Nabisco takes a real swipe at Hydrox by increasing the price of Oreos. Hydrox, which is suddenly much cheaper, starts being seen as Oreos' budget-friendly, off-brand alternative. And it didn't help, says Stella, that Loose Wiles was hell-bent on exposing Oreo as an imposter.
Once Oreo came out, all the Hydrox advertisements had this really, like, whiny quality to them of, like, we here first.
But you gotta remember my name, Hydrox! Hydrox! Don't forget Hydrox! Remember Hydrox!
It's almost like them talking about the other thing is making you have more attention on the other thing. You know, it's like, just say what you're good at.
Yeah, it's not cool. Also, Hydrox wasn't properly trademarked, which made it really hard to cultivate any kind of strong brand recognition.
There were lots of other products called Hydrox on the market, from table water to, like, literal bottles of hydrogen peroxide.
1966 is the beginning of the end. That's when Sunshine Biscuits is acquired by its first company in a long string of new owners, all of which tweak the marketing, the formula, or rebrand Hydrox completely. But despite being beloved by many, Hydrox never lives up to sales expectations. So in 2003, Kellogg's more or less pulls the plug on the cookie. And Hydrox probably would have stayed gone if it hadn't been for a man who is good at resurrecting things from the grave.
I knew immediately that if I could get it back to the original design, I would have a home run.
If you're listening to this podcast, staying informed seems like a big priority. Start your morning with Kansas City Today. This daily news podcast tells you what's going on across the KC Metro in 15 minutes or less. Like and subscribe to Kansas City Today from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Something you should know about Elia Kassoff is that he is an extremely nostalgic person, especially for his childhood.
Well, I had great memories of high school. I mean, I was the head of our high school reunion.
Elia grew up in Palm Springs, California, a land of hot springs, manicured golf courses, and vacation getaway-esque weather.
We were one of the first Jewish families. My mom would order the kosher meat from L.A. and have it shipped on a Greyhound bus.
He didn't eat a lot of packaged goods because his mom was really health conscious. But when he did...
We always were a Hydrox family.
And the reason for this is because of something I haven't yet told you. Suzanne, do you know what the Orthodox Union kosher certification is?
I know that for with kosher food, there's a certain label that needs to be on it to make it kosher. I'm assuming
that's
what it is.
That is exactly what it is. So in 1924, Luce Wiles joined forces with the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America and created the country's first kosher certification program. And this was a real game changer and a great business move. Now, Jewish parents can go to any supermarket and know what packaged foods follow Jewish dietary laws at a simple glance. So Hydrox was the first sandwich cookie to be certified kosher by a long shot.
Wow.
Nabisco items always had beef fat and lard. As a family, we always stayed away from that stuff.
Oreos didn't go kosher and get certified until 1997, more than 70 years later. So for a long time, Hydrox had a huge hold on the Jewish market. And cookies and other treats like this had a huge hold on Elia. Another one of his favorite childhood sweets was Astro Pops, which are these kind of like cone-shaped, brightly colored suckers.
It was my favorite lollipop growing up.
Even as an adult, Elia would regularly buy Astro Pops at his local corner store.
One day I walked in, I said, "Where's your Astro Pops?" And they said, "Oh, I think they're discontinued." And I said, "What?"
So this is around 2010. Elia is a recruiter in the tech industry at the time.
I was freaking out, so I called up the company, which was Spangler Candy. They make Dum Dum lollipops and Circus Peanuts. And I spoke to the president, and it just came out of my mouth. I just said, "Would you sell the rights?"
Spangler would indeed sell the rights. And thus, Elia starts on the arduous journey of reviving brands that had disappeared from shelves. Astro Pops are just the first of many. His new title, CEO for Leaf Brands LLC.
I just said to myself, what other favorite candies did I have as a kid that would help me bring back my own memories of childhood that are no longer being made? Next was Wacky Wafers, then Tarte Tinies.
Naturally, Elia wanted to do the same for his favorite sandwich cookie, Hydrox. At the time, its trademark was owned by Kellogg's. So in order to snag the trademark for himself, Elia had to legally prove that Kellogg's had no intentions to produce more Hydrox.
So how would you even do that?
So he sort of poses as a customer. And he emails Kellogg's and is like, "Hey, like, I really love Hydrox. Like, are you making any more of them?" And they send him this legal letter that's like, "We have discontinued Hydrox. We don't plan to make any more of them." And he uses that to get the trademark.
Sneaky.
Very sneaky. So once he gets the trademark, though, he's still at square one because it's not like Kellogg's gave him the secret formula. So Elia gets an old, vintage 1998 unopened box of Hydrox cookies.
Wait, Craigslist. From where? Craigslist! I love that it's Craigslist.
Yeah.
That's like even kind of dated.
And so then he recruits a food scientist and basically just goes to work trying to recreate the sandwich cookie of his boyhood dreams. And the key to his success is that Elia recruits a ton of Hydrox super fans to taste test the prototypes.
And to get them excited.
Oh, yeah, it definitely gets them excited.
It's like it starts to take a village.
So he starts kind of like mailing out these samples and asking for people's reactions, like, "Is this the same kind of chocolate flavor? Like, how does the texture of the cream compare to what you remember?"
And it was one of the samples, and I don't remember which one, was pretty much almost unanimous.
Finally, in 2015, Elia relaunches Hydrox to much national fanfare.
They're back. Remember Hydrox cookies?
Some 4,000 supermarkets start carrying them.
Hydrox cookies are back. Pretty exciting for the few who remember them.
Kathy Greider in Kansas City told me she totally freaked out when she found out.
When I first came back, I ordered like 5 packages so I could give everyone from my family a package.
A Hydrox comeback.
Look, everyone hates change. If I can slow that down in certain aspects of people's lives, then I've done my job.
So how's that working out for them? Like, since they've brought the cookie back, Was it worth it? I guess it was worth it from an emotional way, probably for anyone who like really cares and is invested, but like in a financial way.
In 2016, Elia says Hydrox made about $500,000 in sales. Oreo, on the other hand, made about $2 billion in sales globally.
We probably sell about the same annually as Mondelez drops on the ground per day in production.
Is it fair to like compare the two? I mean, like what is success in that market, you know?
Yeah, like ultimately, a cookie like that doesn't really have to compete with Oreo. Like, it was never going to compete with Oreo.
So just do what you do.
Yeah, like, this is just how the cookie crumbles. You know, you're not going to have the same kind of sales. But if you ask Elia why Hydrox sales are still low, he says the one to blame partly is Big Oreo, a.k.a. Mondelez, the parent company of Nabisco, because Elia claims that they're sabotaging him.
What?
Specifically, he's alleging that Mondelez workers are coming into grocery stores and hiding Hydrox on higher up shelves when they're not supposed to be there.
I guess it's a thing where the big guys, they go in and they hide the competitor's product, or they'll spray each other's products with sodas. So nobody wants to buy it. And so we have enough of that, that now we're waiting to see what the government does.
In 2018, Leaf Brands actually filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission asking for $800 million in damages. Elia is still waiting to hear back, but obviously I had to reach out to Mondelez.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what's their version of the story?
They sent me a statement, and I'll just read part of it, but they said, "As we have stated numerous times in the past and in numerous forums when Hydrox raises these allegations, our shelf placement in stores stems from the fact that Oreo is the number one cookie in the U.S., loved by consumers and retailers."
Hydrox does have the claim of being like, we're the OG Oreo. So if you just kind of stick with that and ride out the nostalgia wave, that's not so bad.
Because it worked so well for them in the 80s.
Yeah, I actually just realized I just like said the opposite of what I said earlier. It's like, that's a terrible marketing idea. Don't say their name. I'm like, no, just say you're the OG.
That's the thing, though. And so it's all complicated. And I think this all kind of goes into why Kansas City doesn't always celebrate it either. But I think they should.
Well, so, okay, now that I've learned all this, and we've talked about this so much, I am curious, where can I find them?
So Hydrox are barely sold anywhere these days. Their number one distributor is Amazon, but they're always going out of stock, which is why when I found out that my local Cracker Barrel had some boxes on the shelves recently, I stopped what I was doing and I rushed 11 miles to the suburbs.
You went to Cracker Barrel to get it?
I did.
How did you find out? Were you like on an alert or something?
Well, I've been calling places a lot. Like, I called Menards and Amazon sold out right now. So I was getting kind of nervous. Like, am I going to be able to try these?
Are you a rewards member?
I am not.
No. And when I got there, there were only 3 boxes left because an employee named Jenny Neal told me people regularly come to Cracker Barrel explicitly to get Hydrox.
We have a hard time keeping them in stock. I actually have some at home right now. I like to crumble them on vanilla ice cream and make it like cookies and cream.
Do you ever buy Oreos?
I don't buy Oreos because I get those. I get the Hydrox, yeah.
What's behind your loyalty?
I guess for being a kid and liking them so much, and I like to see things come back.
See, now that's fandom.
For a lot of people, eating these cookies is like this tangible connection to their childhood. It's like a safety blanket almost when everything around you has changed.
Absolutely.
And politics. And
this is a totally kind of a tangent, but like, so I worked at a frozen custard place. And when 9/11 happened, we were so busy that day because people wanted to come in and just get some frozen custard and indulge. I remember being like, this is like more than just frozen custard to people. Like, people are lost and want to taste something good to feel good.
I love that example. And it reminds me of something Mary Elizabeth Lewis told me. So she grew up in Kansas City, and she's been a fan of Hydrox ever since eating them with her mom as a kid.
She didn't have any money. I think she made $40 a week.
I kept asking Mary Elizabeth what she thought of the taste of Hydrox cookies. And eventually she was like, "Mackenzie, it's not about the cookie."
Maybe I'm being far too serious, but a lot of times it's not just the Hydrox cookie. It's the story around it. It's the feeling you get. For me, It means a mother's love and sacrifice. That's where the story lies.
So I haven't personally had a Hydrox yet because I was waiting for you. But the most fun part of this episode by far has been talking to people who remember Hydrox, like Mary Elizabeth, and then surprising them with one, because most people haven't had one of these in, like, decades. Do you want to hear some of their reactions?
Well, yes.
I feel like Hydrox is the underdog sandwich cookie.
I like that. And do you know who conceived of it? It was Jacob Luce of Luce Park.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, Kansas City.
Fuck.
It started in Kansas City?
No, I did not learn that they were started here. Kansas City, Mo, I'm shocked.
This is a beautiful thing. And so, is there any way to buy Hydrox cookies? Because I really want to get some for this weekend.
Aw. Okay, what if I told you that in this bag, I had a Hydrox cookie?
Are you kidding me?
Are they legit?
Oh my God.
That's what I remember.
This is such an exciting moment.
That's so good.
I think they are less sweet, but maybe it's because they're not exploding with the cream stuff.
Because they've gotten out of hand. The mega triple stuff, that's a mess.
You don't have to finish it.
They don't like it? So, to me, they taste stale. Now, maybe they are stale. Have they expired? Let's see.
These are brand new.
Now, I remember Hydrox being a little bit stale and brittle like this. Yeah, that's where you get into your Hydrox.
I think Kansas City likes to be excited about itself. And that's one thing that, like, in doing this podcast, it's like what I love about it is that people want to know about the past and be excited about things that people did here. So I think people knowing that it came from here, like, or learning that is, like, really cool and exciting. But whether or not it holds up to the Oreo, that's like a separate.
I know. Maybe,
I'm not trying to, we don't need to go there, man. It's like to each their own.
I am a little bit nervous to eat these because there's been so much buildup. I think I'm going to go for it.
Okay.
I like it. The cream tastes totally different to me.
It's really good.
The texture is very creamy.
The cracker is a little more stale, but I kind of like that because I sometimes think Oreos can be like,
Mushy,
yeah.
I like this way more than I thought I would.
I think it's really good. I like this cookie.
Story worked for you?
Love it. A People's History of Kansas City is a production from KCUR Studios. It's hosted by me, Suzanne Hogan. Our senior producer is Mackenzie Martin, who reported, produced, and mixed this episode with editing by Gabe Rosenberg. Special thanks to Missouri Valley Special Collections and KCUR interns David McKeel, Anna Schmidt, and Isabella Liu, in addition to the many people who talked to Mackenzie about their love of Hydrox cookies, including David Folk, Michael Byers, Martha Atlas, Allison Lawson, Sarah Reinhart, and KCUR's very own Frank Morris, who had honestly way too much to say for us to fit into this episode.
Oreo seems like kind of a race to the bottom. It's like, oh, we'll make a Hydrox, except really sweet all the way around. And the chocolate cookie part doesn't really matter. You just want the creamy inside part.
You heard archival audio this episode from Nabisco, Sunshine Biscuits, and Spangler Candy, in addition to NBC, ABC, AMC, NPR, and KCAL. Music this episode from Poddington Bear, Booker T and the MGs, Vincent Lopez and his orchestra, Billy Murray, Ben Sullivan's Novelty Orchestra, the Waldorf Astoria Dance Orchestra, and Blue Dot Sessions. For more on this story, there's a great Planet Money podcast about this called The Hydrox Resurrection, and a History Channel documentary called The Cookie Wars. Mackenzie also highly recommends Stella Park's cookbook, Brave Tart, which features an incredible recipe for making homemade Oreos that many home cooks swear by. All right, that's it. Let us know what you thought of this episode by emailing us at peopleshistorykc@kcur.org. We'll be back in April with a really fun story about a Missouri family who is saving my favorite way to consume music, the cassette tape. Until then, I'm Suzanne Hogan. Take care, and thanks for listening.